I'm Annie Corrigan. This is Earth Eats.
You know, writing a book about food waste tends to make most dinner parties a bit awkward. But that's just kind of the cost of doing business, I suppose.
Jonathan Bloom studies food waste. He'll tell us what bugs him most about shopping at grocery stores. In the spirit of eating the whole animal, Luke Runyon brings us a story about Rocky Mountain oysters, a couple soup recipes with Chef Daniel Orr to repurpose your Thanksgiving leftovers. Then,
we were probably somewhat naive from the standpoint that we thought, hey, we'll just let people just shoot them a couple deer seasons, we'll get rid of them. Well, it didn't work.
Wild pigs wreak havoc on farms and ranches. We'll hear about the various efforts to control the population. Our news folks are taking the week off, but there are still articles to check out on the website. A couple about last week's National Organic Standards Board's meeting. Officials did not decide whether or not hydroponics can be certified organic, but they did decide about a certain food additive. Carrageenan is derived from a species of red algae. It's used to thicken and stabilize a range of products, and it's a common vegetarian alternative to gelatin. Read about why it was removed from a list of approved ingredients in organic products. EarthEats.org is our website. Now, from Indiana Public Media, feral swine have been reported in a majority of states. They number into the hundreds or maybe even the low thousands in Indiana. The pigs are an invasive species that were brought to the Hoosier State in the late 80s. Federal officials estimate they're responsible for hundreds of millions of dollars in damage to crops each year. And now federal dollars are being pumped into Indiana in an effort to eradicate the population. A warning that this story includes a graphic description of hunting that some listeners might find upsetting. The story's about 7 minutes long. Here's Sarah Whitmire.
Wild pigs have been a problem in the U.S. for more than half a century. They live in deep brush, and they're largely nocturnal, so it's not too often people spot them.
You always have that boogeyman feeling in the dark in the woods that something is sneaking up on you.
Chuck Brenner is one of the most experienced wild hog hunters in the state. Several years ago, he was squirrel hunting when he found himself face to face with a wild hog. These aren't like your pink farm pigs. They have bristles down their backs and they have tusks. In some cases, they can weigh up to 400 pounds. The hog startled Brenner. He fell and in the ruckus dropped his gun. All he had was his knife.
When he'd be on this side of that branch like that big around, I duck over here and I jabbed at him. This went back and forth for, they counted 15 holes in his neck before I hit the jugular vein and he bled out there. And he never took his eyes off me till the moment he died. He just sat there grunting at me, growling, a deep growl gruntle sound until he just fell over and gave it up.
Since then, Brenner has killed more than 100 wild hogs.
I got scars from them, and I get kind of crazy sometimes, or used to, hide behind a cedar tree when you see some come and then reach out and grab one and try to catch it.
He's sitting on his porch. A stuffed wild boar is mounted on the house over his right shoulder.
You see the blood on the porch? This porch has been... We finally put up a hangar out back made of, I think it's 3-inch square tubing steel with a crank on it to put everything out back to, you know, clean the porch up.
A lot of times he collected hair or blood from the pigs and sent the samples to the Division of Fish and Wildlife so biologists could study the DNA and determine where the hogs came from. Turns out humans moved the pigs here so they could hunt them. That's not only illegal, but it can be devastating to a place like Indiana where livestock and farming is so important.
We have a problem here. They are causing damage to agricultural crops as well as ecological damage.
That's Steve Bax from the Department of Natural Resources in Indiana. The pigs tear through cornfields and cause millions of dollars in crop damage each year. They're also polluting streams and creeks. They compete with native species for food, and perhaps the biggest concern is the potential for disease. That could threaten Indiana's billion-dollar pork industry and affect other livestock as well.
We were probably
somewhat naive from the standpoint that we thought, hey, we'll just let people just shoot them 365 days a year. There's no license required. We figured a couple deer seasons, we'll get rid of them. And I think that was the feeling across much of the Midwest. Well, it didn't work.
The issue is once hunters introduced pigs here, there was really no natural predator that was going to keep the population in check. A sow can have two litters of about 10 pigs a year. And by the time she's having the second litter, females in her first litter can be pregnant.
So you almost get the rabbit effect or the domino effect.
Hunters are typically only interested in going after the big boars, but it's the sows that are the reproductive engine of the groups. In 2014, Congress took notice. There had been money in the Farm Bill to fight wild hogs in the Southeast and in the Southwest, but now that the country's breadbasket was threatened, money was shifted to the Midwest for the first time. The first major change, no more public hunting of pigs.
The reason is, if we did allow that, then we might as well put a sign up that says, dump your pigs here.
The preferred method is trapping.
Good. The smaller pieces, that's to keep the little piglets from going out. And then the total height of this is about 4 to 5 inches taller than your typical cattle panel.
Big corral traps can capture an entire group of pigs. And that's important because pigs are considered to be very intelligent animals.
If somebody just goes out there and wants to shoot pigs or hunt them, they may only take a couple.
Lee Humberg runs the USDA office that oversees the pig management efforts. He says the problem with that is you then bust up the group of hogs you're trying to catch.
And they've then been educated, I'm getting shot at on this property, let's get out of here, we're not coming back. So you've lost that property as a focal area, and it'll be hard to ever trap pigs on there in the near future.
The traps are actually elevated off the ground. Pigs are more likely to go in it if they can see through it. Cameras watch the traps and the pigs' movement. Folks on Humberg's team can use their phones to remotely trigger the traps.
We're selective of when we drop the traps. We're trying to get all that we know based on the camera evidence are coming and using that trap. So if there's eight coming, we try not to drop that trap until all eight are in that trap.
And it's working. Humberg's team removed 129 hogs last year. That's more than double what they removed the previous year. The Farm Bill money gets shifted around, so states that are getting closer to eliminating pigs might get a little more to cap off the population and stop it completely. This year, Indiana is getting enough money to double the size of its team fighting hogs. Four states, Idaho, Maryland, New York, Washington, were deemed pig-free last year and are just being monitored. This year, officials are projecting New Jersey and Wisconsin will be added to that list. For WFIU News, I'm Sarah Whitmire.
Indiana's goal of eradication is different than some other states that have much larger populations. For example, in Texas and Florida, where wild pigs number in the millions, the goal right now is just to reduce the damage they're causing. And one more note from Sarah. Yes, hunters do eat the meat. Chuck Brenner describes it as pork, but with a beef texture. Watch a video at eartheats.org. Our reporters are immersed in the food system, so when it came to light that Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon hadn't yet tried Rocky Mountain oysters, that delicacy of the American West, he just couldn't let that stand. Here's Luke, reporting from Colorado.
I pride myself in having an iron stomach, but I've never felt more hesitation for the food in front of me than at this moment.
Okay. Standing in front of a plate of fried testicles.
I'm at Bruce's Bar in Severance, Colorado, looking for any excuse to not eat this basket of battered, deep-fried beef, lamb, and bison testicles. You might know them by their nicknames, lamb fries, Montana tenders, or my personal favorite, cowboy caviar. Here at Bruce's, they're Rocky Mountain oysters. And before we get to my first bite, let me explain how I got here.
Okay, so we're in Severance now.
That orange building on the corner is Bruce's. I moved to Colorado from Illinois in 2011, tried some new foods like elk and yak, but still I felt like I was missing out on something. I needed some Colorado cred, and the Rocky Mountain oyster was my last hill to climb. I settled on Bruce's because it is the center of the Rocky Mountain oyster universe. The tradition is baked into the town of Severance. Take the sign on the way in. Welcome to the town of Severance, where the geese fly and the bulls cry. And of course, there's the name of the town, Severance. It literally means the state of being separated or cut off. The outside of Bruce's is painted with cartoon bulls with their legs crossed. There's one riding a motorcycle holding a sign that says, "Still got mine."
Hey, Dennis.
Must be Luke.
Yes.
Dennis, nice to meet you.
How's it going?
Good.
And you couldn't ask for a better expert than Dennis Guffey. He's been in charge of the kitchen at Bruce's for more than 40 years. And he's my Rocky Mountain oyster guide.
I don't know if you've ever eaten Rocky Mountain oysters before.
This actually will be my first
time
today.
I think you'll like it. They're actually really good. Just don't think of what you're eating when you eat it, okay?
Easier said than done, Dennis. He says a lot of people have a hard time taking the first bite. I ask why.
I really don't know. I think some people are just funny about the food they eat.
Like many things with Wild West origins, there's a rich tapestry of Western lore built around Rocky Mountain oysters. There are old tales of cowboys holding big parties to fry up the testicles. Some ranches still hold so-called nut fries. Dennis says he hears customers say they're an aphrodisiac.
So, buffalo, lamb, beef.
After slicing, dicing, breading, and deep frying, Dennis brings out the basket with a side of cocktail sauce.
So you guys want to sit down and have a little bite?
And now, the moment of truth.
I'm a little nervous, actually.
Ah, they're good.
Okay. Standing in front of a plate of fried testicles.
I go with the more exotic bison oyster as my first taste.
Oh my god.
There is no good way to say this, but they were surprisingly juicy. And I know this is cliche, but the bison tasted like chicken. Dennis asks how I feel.
Well, now I feel like I'm kind of more of a Coloradan than I was before. Now I can like stake a flag and say, I've had Rocky Mountain oysters. I am more of a Coloradan today than I was yesterday.
There you go.
Anything else that's important to know, Dennis?
Other than just coming to Bruce's and having a ball, what else can I say?
I feel like that's a great way to close out the story, actually.
Yeah, yep.
In Severance, Colorado, I'm Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
See a picture of Luke eating his very first Rocky Mountain oyster at harvestpublicmedia.org. Coming up on Earth Eats, leftovers from Thanksgiving do not have to end up in the trash. Instead, we make soup. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location available at whereisurgent.com. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for being here. When we talk about food waste, it's not just leftovers that get tossed in the landfill. It's parts of foods that we've convinced ourselves aren't worth eating. Author Jonathan Bloom is here today to talk more about food waste. He's the author of American Wasteland. When I first started thinking about this conversation with you, the first thing that popped into my mind is a video that I saw on YouTube from Food Beast TV, where this guy ate an entire apple. He started at the top and he worked his way to the bottom, eating core, stem, the whole thing. And that was surprisingly provocative because it made me think really for the first time that what we consider edible or inedible is really not about, say, food safety. There's so much more to it.
Well, how do you eat your apples, Annie?
I go around and then I leave a core.
Of course. That's the culturally appropriate way to eat apples in this country. But I think that video is really interesting because it shows that there's more than one way to do things. And what I like to say is the apple core is a social construct. I think that speaks to how we approach food on many levels.
Where did we get that idea that, let's say, the apple core is inedible or, I don't know, let's say the stems on broccoli just don't taste as good? Where do we come up with these ideas?
Well, I think in the case of apples, there's a sense that we don't want to eat the seeds. And then there's trace amounts of cyanide in apple seeds. So you probably don't want to do that every day. But I think it came from a more agrarian background where we were saving seeds. And so we approach things a bit differently. In terms of not eating broccoli stalks or eating the florets instead, and I think of asparagus heads in the same manner, I think that's just a preference that has developed over the years. And unfortunately, we've reached this point where now not only do we want to only eat certain parts of food and to tragic consequences, thinking of chickens, things like that, where we only want that nice white meat from the chicken breast, and it seems the entire rest of the bird is sent elsewhere, oftentimes discarded. But yeah, those preferences have developed where we don't want to eat anything that doesn't look perfect. And there's this superficiality that has developed in American culture in regard to food.
Well, let's just jump right to that. So us as consumers at the grocery store, you said it, we're talking about apples, we're going to pick that round, gorgeous, perfect apple instead of the gnarly apple that might have, let's say, a wormhole here or a bruise over there. Even if that gnarly apple might end up tasting better, what can we do to just change consumers' desires or expectations?
Yeah, I think there are a few things here. And first of all, we as consumers do have a role to play, and we can voice our opinions on not needing food to look perfect and not requiring that homogeneity in our food supply. And I think that is that word and that concept is a little more important than just focusing on blemishes or damaged goods, because I think there are two categories here. The fresh market in our country requires things to be the exact same shape, size, and color. And if anything doesn't meet one of those three requirements, it tends to get tossed. And so if we as consumers voice to the stores that we want those items, we're fine with a cucumber that's a little bit curved or a banana that's straight, then there will be a follow through. And from an economic standpoint, why would those producers want to throw away as much as they now do? But I think in addition to voicing that opinion, just acting with your food dollars and maybe shopping at farmers markets or even growing your own, where you can recognize that the appearance doesn't connote poor taste. And so appearance hopefully won't trump taste when it comes to what kind of food you're eating.
And sometimes at farmers markets, if you ask vendors, do you have tomatoes that are maybe not so pretty that I could turn into sauce? I know that's an option for some people.
Yeah, it's pretty common to buy seconds, and the sauce tomato being the classic example. But I like to go to vendors and ask them if they have any funky looking vegetables, because I think those kind of foods have a little more character. So some people use the word ugly to connote that it looks different, but I like to call it quirky fruits and vegetables. And mostly it's a way of having fun, but also hopefully communicating that all food is edible, and let's try to lower our standards on appearance a bit. But since focusing on food waste, I've tried to grow more of our own food for my family and shop at farmers markets more, where I can customize the amount of food I'm purchasing. And that's a real pet peeve of mine at the stores, at supermarkets, where they have produce and other items packaged in a certain way so that you're not choosing how much you receive. And I think that's a real driver of waste.
And anything to get us closer to our food.
Oh, amen. Yeah, I think that's the name of the game these days.
I thought about that as well. I wonder if there's a connection between our lack of cooking, how far away we are from our own kitchens, and this incredible food waste figure
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think they're directly linked. I think the fact that we have collectively stepped out of the kitchen to a certain extent and entrusted the food industry with a good portion of our meals means that we've lost some of those traditional food ways, and so we don't know how to repurpose leftovers into other meals. We might not even know or want to save leftovers in the first place. At the same time, we certainly have lost track of when things go bad or how you tell when a food is good or not. And when in doubt, people tend to throw things out, unfortunately. So I think the lack of cooking has a couple of impacts on food waste. And I don't quite buy the notion that people don't have time to cook. I think it's that they don't want to cook.
I wonder if you could just talk about your personal shopping habits. How often do you go to the store? How much food do you buy at a time?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know if you want to ask that question. For someone who thinks about food waste almost all the time, it's a bit challenging to be the person who shops for their family. So I do put a good amount of effort into making sure that we don't have too much on hand at one time. But I think the universal advice would be to maybe shop more frequently, but buy less each time. But it does mean a bit more effort is expended in buying food.
More time.
Yeah, more time and effort. And I recognize that not everyone has that these days. But I would say that people have more time than they realize.
Jonathan Bloom's book is American Wasteland. He visited Earth Eats in 2014. Connect with him on Twitter at Wasted Food. Was that Jonathan Bloom said that we don't know how to repurpose leftovers into other meals? Let's change that, shall we? First up, our yellow lentil bisque.
Are you ready to make some soup?
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to get started by adding the extra virgin olive oil to our pot and quickly following it with the chopped garlic. Okay, and you're looking for that kind of roasty, toasty aroma to come through. The garlic will just start to turn a little bit brown, and that's when you want to have your other vegetables ready, because you don't want that garlic to burn or it will get bitter. All right, so we've got our onions. All right, we're just gonna stir those around, coat them with that oil and garlic mixture. And the other great thing about this dish is you're going to puree it anyhow. So you don't have to be really careful about the way you cut up your vegetables. Just kind of whack them and toss them in there. And then you just want to cook them until they're very, very tender. Okay, we're going to toss in the carrots, tomatoes. Okay, and then we've got our red lentils. These red lentils, one of the great things about it is that they cook real, real quickly. Basically, you bring it to a boil and 10, 15 minutes, you've got a soup. The other things that you could add to this, if at this point, if you'd like, you could throw in a bay leaf. At the end of the growing season, usually there's some sage around, some rosemary. So use some of those kind of late autumn herbs and you're cooking. All right, I'm gonna finish by adding a little bit of the chili powder and then some salt. We're gonna cover this, bring it to a boil and let it simmer for 20 minutes and you got soup. And then if you'd like, if you wanna make it into a bisque, then that's when you puree it. And that's gonna give you a nice rich viscosity, nice mouthfeel. Where, you know, usually people think of bisque having a lot of cream in them, some bacon in it. So we're kind of replicating the mouthfeel without putting all those extra calories and meat products in it. What we're going to make next is a broccoli soup. And it's a broccoli and basil soup with soy. In this case, the soy is going to be tofu. So it will have a creamy, unctuous texture and flavor, but without adding heavy cream. The leaves of the broccoli are also great for the soup,
But you got to get rid of the caterpillars.
Oh, sure enough. So. Are the leaves something that you could, I don't know, steam and serve with?
Yeah, if you're doing a stir fry, use them like you would use any greens. You can use them as you'd use beet greens or collards or any of those kind of things. Now for this recipe, we want to cook the broccoli till it's tender. Put a decent amount of salt in there because that's going to allow the water temperature to actually increase over the boiling point and it'll cook the vegetables even quicker. In the meantime, we're going to go back to our trusty blender. We're going to put everything except for the broccoli into the blender and get it ready to whirl. A half a jalapeno, 2 garlic cloves, 15 basil leaves, 2 tablespoons of ginger, and a half pound of silken tofu. I'm going to add 1 little ladle of this cooking liquid. When you're cooking pasta, you don't throw away all the pasta water. You can incorporate a little bit of that into your sauce. I also like to blanch more than one thing in the same pot. You're building up vitamins into that water and you're reusing those again and again. So you can also save that and almost have it as a vegetable stock after you've cooked a lot of different vegetables in it. As soon as that stem is tender enough, it's ready to go. And again, the better blender you have, the less cooking you have to do to the broccoli. When you pour it freshly out of that blender, it's kind of a little bit foamy and light, and I think it will just kind of dance on your tongue.
So there's that. Now soup for those leftover turkey bits. Daniel is also adding some quinoa to this one.
I like to cook them and use them as stuffings in omelets or to stuff peppers instead of the typical rice. So simple to cook. Basically, all you do is you pour it into a pan, cover it with water, and cook it. And you just need to keep adding water until you see these little kind of white, wormy-looking things. Doesn't sound very appealing, but it's really, really tasty. If you just grab a little handful of that, I put a little bit of garlic, salt, and pepper, and a little olive oil with it. This is also something that you can make a big batch and then put it in little resealable Ziplocs and put in the freezer. And then whenever you want it, you just pull it out, thaw it, pull it out the day before. You could even throw it in the microwave and thaw it out and have them ready at any time for any meal. So it's great like that just as a salad or as a stuffing. But you can also mix it into soups. And that's one of the things that I've done for you today. Made a little soup. I had some smoked turkey broth. Put the quinoa in there, some carrots, some collard greens. You could throw leeks, you could throw turnips, you could throw parsnips, anything you want in there. And then the kumquats, the little oranges that are in there, give it a really fun, interesting flavor and make it very different. And they have a nice citrus pop as you eat them. So kumquat has kind of a sweet but a touch of bitterness to it. But I think it really goes well with the smokiness of the turkey.
The recipes are on our website along with squash biscuits, squash mac and cheese, squash creme brulee. It's Squash O'Clock at eartheats.org. Thanks to our team, Avon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. And special thanks this week to Sarah Whitmire of Indiana Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And thank you for spending some time with us today. I'm Annie Corrigan.